Thank you for tuning in today and welcome back to another episode of The Source. I'm your host, Zan Raza. And today I'll be talking to author and independent journalist, Fabian Scheidler. Fabian has written numerous books, the latest being The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of a Failing Civilization. Fabian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start this interview with a recap of international developments surrounding the Israeli assault on Gaza, which thus far has claimed the lives of 34,183 Palestinians, most of them being women and children. Recently, an independent investigation led by former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna found that Israel has still not been able to provide any evidence to support its claim that the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, staff members are part of the terrorist organization Hamas. In January, Israel accused UNRWA of being infiltrated by Hamas, a claim that was not only uncritically reported by Western media, but also led nations such as the US, UK, and Germany to cut their funding, despite the fact that 2.3 million people in Gaza rely on this agency for food, shelter, and medicine. Germany has decided to resume its cooperation with UNRWA, but the US thus far has refused to do so. In another international development, the United States recently vetoed a resolution in the UN Security Council aimed at granting the state of Palestine full membership in the United Nations. US Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood informed the Security Council that the veto, quote, does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but is acknowledgement that it can only be achieved through direct negotiations between the parties, unquote. In light of these international developments, what do you make of the United States' actions on the international stage? Has it been constructive when it comes to addressing the Israel-Palestine issue?
No, in fact, it has been very destructive, and the United States is more and more isolated on the international scene. The vote in the Security Council was a reflection of that. The United States voted against Palestinian statehood, although practically most of the other members of the Security Council were in favor, only two abstentions and two abstained. The United States then said that they are in favor of a two-state solution, but it has to come through negotiations. Who is going to negotiate here? Gazans are bombed, have been bombed for half a year now, and there is no independent Palestinian authority. They are completely dependent on Israel, and they are deeply corrupted. And the thing is that if you, the U.S. has a track record of decades of saying that they are in favor of a two-state solution, but in fact blocking it because they allowed Israel to go forward with the colonization of the West Bank, with the blockade of Gaza, which lasted for 16 years, and now with the war. And I think the international community, apart from some Western states like Germany, are completely aware of the isolation of the United States, and that finally, I think a solution of that dire situation, can be achieved only either without the United States or by bypassing the United States or by the United States becoming aware that their stance on Israel and Gaza has no future.
Let's look at this issue from a regional perspective, namely between Israel and Iran. After an Israeli airstrike in early April that destroyed an Iranian consulate in Syria, Damascus, killing a top military advisor of Iran, Iran responded by firing more than 300 projectiles at a military installation in Israel that included around 170 drones and over 120 rockets, causing minimum damage, according to the Israeli Defense Force. Days later, Israel responded with an airstrike targeted an air defense facility near the city of Isfahan in central Iran. Isfahan is where Iran has nuclear facilities, a drone manufacturing facility, and also a major airbase. According to various reports, the damage was quite limited as well. Western nations widely condemned Iran's attack on Israel, and when it came to Israel, they simply requested it to exercise restraint. The European Union agreed to tighten sanctions against Iran in retaliation for its attack on Israel and announced it will target all components manufactured in the EU that are used in the production of unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, or ballistic missiles. How do you view this spat between Israel and Iran, as well as the reaction of the West?
Well, it was the reactions of the West were deeply hypocritical. because Israel started the whole conflict with their assault on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which was in fact an act of war under international law. I mean, the embassies and consulates are considered to be the territory of that state. So that was indeed Iranian territory that was hit. And there was no real condemnation of that act by Western states, which is really amazing, given that this was outrageous and things like that hardly ever happen. I mean, usually even in wars and conflicts, embassies and consulates are respected. So Israel clearly started the whole affair. Then Iran was in a difficult situation. They had to react to just, otherwise they would be seen as very weak. They went to the UN to demand a diplomatic intervention, but that was not possible due to the interventions of the United States. So they had to do something. And so they went, I'm not going to justify what they did, but they did that in a, even Western observers noted that it was very restrained in its range. It was for 9 hours long, which allowed the US and the Israeli Defense Forces and others to take down these missiles and drones and so on. Seymour Hersh even reported that there were, according to his sources, talks between the Pentagon and Iranian military to make sure that no severe damage would be caused on Israel's territory, because the US clearly don't want this kind of war between Iran, Israel, and the rest. And so it seems plausible to me what Sy Hersh has reported here, that the Pentagon, not the Biden administration, they sort of let it go. They sort of let it happen that the Pentagon took the initiative to make sure that this was that would not escalate into a regional war. And I think the Israeli response was sort of also restrained. I think what the US told them, that was also according to the reports of Seymour Hersh, is that if you want to go to war with Iran, you're on your own. And so I think the restraint in the Israeli response is a reflection of that they don't have full backing of the US for major hits. But still, there's a huge risk of real escalation here.
Let us now look at some domestic developments happening around the issue of Israel and Gaza. You recently wrote an article in Sheer Post in the Berliner Zeitung entitled "Gaza and Germany's Path to Authoritarianism." In it, you document how the German government is cracking down on voices critical of Israel's policies, endangering civil liberties and freedom of expression. In particular, you highlight the cases of former Greek finance minister and politician Yanis Varoufakis and the world-renowned British-Palestinian surgeon from Glasgow University, Hassan Aboussitar, who have been banned from entering Germany and for engaging in any political activity here. This political ban took place in the context of a Palestine conference in Berlin that took place on April 12th, which had been organized by Jews, Palestinians, and Germans, and was eventually raided by the police. The German government justified its actions by stating that the conference and the speakers aimed to propagate anti-Semitic, anti-Israel sentiments, as well as glorify or sympathize with the terrorist actions of Hamas. Can you comment on this case and talk about the state of civil liberties in Germany in relation to criticism of Israel?
Yes, the crackdown on that conference was really outrageous. And you know, it was supposed to take place for 3 days. And after 2 hours, the German police shut down the conference. They took off the electricity on the claims that there was a certain Salman Aboussitar who was speaking via video message, and they claimed that this person didn't have a right to speak in Germany. There was a ban on him. The people who were responsible for the conference didn't know about that. Salman Aboussitar even himself claimed that he didn't know about that. So the reasons given to shut down a whole conference were quite flimsy. And in fact, it raises serious questions about the rule of law here. Even if one person had made comments via video message, that were not in line with German law, there's no reason to shut down a whole conference. You know, this really reminds me of what happened in the US in the McCarthy era, where dissenters and critics of the government were labeled as communists, as anti-American, and so on, where we saw a huge crackdown on civil liberties. And we have a similar development in Germany, unfortunately. And it's really absurd. Let's take another case, the case of the Berlinale, the film festival. The first prize, the award for documentaries went to two filmmakers. One was Yuval Abraham from the Israeli newscast Plus 972, who, by the way, has also revealed the story about the AI use in the Israeli military assault on Gaza. And he's from Israel, and Basil Adra from Palestine. And when they received the award, they referred to Israel as an apartheid state. And there was a huge outrage in the German media and among German politicians. The mayor of Berlin and many others called these filmmakers anti-Semites. And we have to take into consideration that the two most renowned human rights organizations in the world, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, used that term for Israel. They have been using it for years after thorough research and studies on the ground for good reason, because Palestinians have not the same rights on their territory as Israelis. But if you use a term like apartheid, if you refer to human rights organizations like Amnesty International in Germany, you are a hater of Israel, you are a non-person, you are an anti-Semite. So it's really an absurd situation, and it goes on and on and on. You know, very renowned artists and scientists like Nancy Fraser, like Laurie Anderson, like Masha Gessen have been uninvited from their teaching commitments and so on in Germany, because they just named what is going on in Gaza, the severe human rights violations, the severe violations of international law, which are very well documented. But if you say that, and if you refer to the United Nations General Assembly that demanded an immediate ceasefire by an overwhelming majority, you're an anti-Semite in Germany. And that's really quite disturbing given the German history. And in my article, I also mentioned that I think this is a complete misinterpretation of German history, of the Holocaust, of the Shoah. Because what the German governments and parts of the press claim is that the consequence of the Shoah should be that we have an unconditional support for the state of Israel and its government, no matter who is in government, no matter what they do. They are extreme right-wingers now in government. And my conclusion from German history is that we as Germans should have a commitment to human rights independent of nationality, of religion, of the color of skin. So Gazans, Palestinians deserve the same protection, the same security as Israeli citizens. But the idea of the German government and the German press is quite the contrary. They call it reason of state. So we have to stick to whatever the Israeli state is doing. And I think that's a travesty of the lessons from the German past that we should draw.
Let us look at another development now, namely the war in Ukraine. After months of delay due to political differences, the US Congress was finally able to pass a comprehensive $95.3 foreign aid package on Tuesday, April 23rd. This aid package includes $61 billion to support Ukraine in its war against Russia, $26 billion for Israel and humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones around the world, including the Gaza Strip, and $8.12 billion to, quote, fight communist China, unquote, in the Indo-Pacific region, particularly for Taiwan. As far as Ukrainian aid is concerned, most of the funds will go to replenish U.S. stockpiles and purchasing U.S. defense systems. One notable difference, however, is the Army Tactical Missile Systems, also known as ATACMS. Until now, the US had sent ATACMS with a range of 160 kilometers. Now, for the first time, they will send ATACMS with a range of 300 kilometers, which, according to many military analysts appearing in Western media, will make a significant difference in favor of the Ukrainian military. What do you think of this latest round of aid? Can it lead Ukraine finally a victory against Russia?
It depends on what you define as victory. The whole idea that was propagated for 2 years in the West, in the US and in Germany, that Ukraine would be able to take back all the territory, Donbass and Crimea, is completely ridiculous. No one believes that. And it's completely out of line with the with the situation on the ground. Russia is advancing, and Ukraine is running out of people. It's a very serious problem. The army is demotivated after 2 years of war. They have severe difficulties of recruiting people. Millions of Ukrainians who could serve are abroad. They are trying to crack down on these people. They are trying to withdraw their diplomatic aid in countries like Germany to force them to come back to Ukraine, which they probably won't, because they won't die in a war that doesn't make any sense and any progress. And so this is the key problem for Ukraine. Now, when they get new weapons, it will take weeks and months for to be delivered. The Czech government has also bought up internationally ammunition for Ukraine, which is an interesting case because it's, the Czech Republic is part of NATO, and apparently NATO is running out of ammunition. So there's another question here. When the war in Ukraine started, the NATO military budget was 20 times the budget of Russia. And so we could ask why we are running out of ammunition so fast. And I think one of the answers is that there is a huge huge scale corruption in the Western military system, especially in the US, but also in other countries. But that's another story. Does it make a difference? Well, it will make a certain difference when these weapons arrive, but they will not turn the tide in favor of a Ukrainian offensive that could take back all the territory. What it does is to prolong the war, and we have already something that you could call a new Verdun. You know, the big battle in the First World War, which didn't make any advance for a year or even longer, and where hundreds and thousands of soldiers died. And we have to end this situation. And the only way to end it is not more military aid, but negotiations. And what could these negotiations be about? They could be about a neutrality for Ukraine. Would have been part of the solution from the outset, as many, even including Henry Kissinger, had said before the war. That would have, Russia had demanded neutrality of Ukraine for a long time, if the West had conceded that Ukraine wouldn't be part of NATO, we wouldn't have a war, most probably. Still, it should be part of negotiations. I think it would be in the interest of the Ukrainian people. Of course, they need security guarantees of one form or another. And then there must be negotiations about the status of the territories held by Russia now. And the negotiation position of Ukraine is much weaker now than it was at the beginning of the war. At the beginning of the war, Russia could have retreated to the lines before February 24, 2022. I think they won't do it today, which is a sad story because I'm in favor of recognizing international borders. So that was a severe breach of international law by Russia to invade. But now we have a situation on the ground where we have to prevent the further killing of hundreds and thousands of people for moving the border like 5 kilometers to the east or 5 kilometers to the west for the next 10 years. I think we have to stop that, and we should engage in negotiations.
Let us look at the Nord Stream pipeline and get your perspective on some recent developments, especially considering the fact that you were the first European journalist to interview Seymour Hersh after he revealed how the US bombed the Nord Stream pipeline. For those who missed this interview, we will link that for you in the description of this video. In February, there were a number of developments in connection with the Nord Stream pipeline. Sweden announced that it closed its investigation into the explosion of the Nord Stream pipeline on the ground that it had no jurisdiction in the case, and it handed over the information obtained to the German investigators. After Sweden, the Danish authorities also ended their investigation and concluded that the pipelines had been deliberately sabotaged. However, they decided not to pursue the investigation any further as there was no basis for any criminal proceedings in Denmark. The results of the investigations were not made public either. Can you provide your assessments of these developments and talk about this affair 2 years later?
Yeah, I mean, what we see basically in Western countries, those who have access to evidence like Sweden, like the US, of course, Denmark and Germany, there seems to be no real interest in making progress in that case. The interesting thing about Sweden is that they claimed jurisdiction in the first place, although many legal experts said they didn't have any jurisdiction. And now they say, no, I mean, we don't have jurisdiction, we don't won't go on with the case. So that's quite contradictory. And the suspicion here is that they claim jurisdiction to gather evidence, and now they close the case and they say, well, we won't give any statement. What I have heard is that the Swedish authorities have transferred the evidence there. Apparently they have a container full of things they have gathered at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. They've given that to German authorities, but German authorities are not speaking either. So I think there is very little interest in coming up with real evidence about who did it. And the reason is clear, because still the story that Seymour Hersh broke has not been debunked or debunked, really. We don't know if it's true, we don't know if it's partly true, but still there is the possibility that the US was behind it, or at least that they knew about what was going on. 1 month after Seymour Hersh broke his story, the New York Times and Die Zeit and others came up with their sailboat stories saying that Ukrainians were involved with that sailboat. There were serious doubts about whether this would be feasible. The investigation, the reports were, if someone would have provided these reports in the New York Times and Die Zeit in a as a student in his first semester, I think any professor of journalism would have refuted that, because it was so full of mistakes, of miscalculations, of questions that were not asked. So later on, they came up with more and more stuff, but still there is no real clue whether that Ukrainian sailboat story is really part of the story. What is entirely possible is that both the Hersh story and the Ukrainian sailboat story are part of a puzzle. Either the Ukrainian sailboat story being a red herring to distract from the real plan, or which would be another scenario, that Seymour Hersh had a prior version to what happened, and the intelligence community came up with a second version, which also included a sailboat and Ukrainian forces. So still, we don't know what happened, but I think it's not surprising that we don't see a real interest in finding out what happened, because if the US was involved in one way or another, that could be the end of NATO. I mean, the US bombing crucial infrastructure of its allies, including Germany, I mean, that's a severe case. And in an alliance, I mean, that would be really an earthquake. So I think it will take a long time. I hope one day we'll get behind that. And we have to keep on asking the questions. What is really remarkable is that the version of Cy Hirsch is rarely ever discussed in our media. Although it is plausible, which doesn't mean that it is necessarily true. But if you look at such a major crime, the largest case of sabotage in recent history, you should go on by criminalistic standards. I mean, every whodunit that you see on television every night, you ask who has a motive, who has the means to do it, what kind of theories can we have about that? And of course, the US had a lot of motives. They wanted to sever the ties between Russia and Western Europe, which is an old, long history of US geopolitical strategies. They wanted to sell their liquid gas to Europe instead of Russia selling their cheaper gas. So there are lots of motives, and the US said it repeatedly. US President Biden said it standing next to Olaf Scholz in a press conference in the White House. He said, we will end this pipeline. And it's hardly ever discussed how it is possible that a US president says that they will be able to destroy crucial infrastructure of an ally, and even less discussed whether they could be part of that story. There was so much distraction for years now over the pipeline issue. The first time many media claimed that Russia blew up its own pipeline. It's such a ridiculous proposal. No evidence at all. After quite a time, even the intelligence communities, the Washington Post and others, came up with a conclusion that there's no trace of evidence whatsoever, but they wasted months with that allegation instead of looking in the other direction to the US.
Fabian Scheidler, independent journalist and author, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for tuning in today. Please don't forget to join our alternative channels on Rumble, Telegram, and a podcast called Podbean. YouTube, which is owned by Google, can shadow ban and censor us at any time. And in case that ever happens, we won't be able to reach you even with an announcement. And if you're watching our videos regularly, make sure to become a monthly donator and institute a standing order via Patreon, PayPal, or directly to our bank account. We have 148,000 subscribers, and if all of our subscribers just donate $2 to $3 a month via a standing order, we will be able to cover all of our costs, which include website maintenance, insurance, tax advising, video editing, translation, voiceover, and many others. It is a core principle not to take any money from governments or corporations. We don't even allow advertisement, all with the goal to remain independent and provide you with a perspective that you won't hear in the mainstream media. I thank you for tuning in and for your support. See you next time.